My name is Ed Naylor from Washington, D.C. Maybe just a word. Do you get stuff about who's going to be teaching so you know me better than I do?
No.
Oh, good. Well, let me share about 40 seconds worth of information. I think I'm here because Sarah was asked to teach. I think that's the real reason. You need to skip dinner the next hour and pick hers up because she's very good also. But I'm happy to be here. I'm from Washington, D.C. There I'm the Executive Director of Lutheran Social Services of the National Capital Area. I take it most of you are Lutheran-type folks. Is that kind of true? Yeah, I see. Sort of Lutheran. Well, that's good enough. And you know that all around the country, the Lutheran Church has over 400 social ministry organizations like Lutheran Social Services, as well as a whole variety of other names, providing a whole variety of services to people who have needs. That's one of the things the Lutheran Church has been good at, really good at, in terms of historically responding with what we have believed to be the mandates of our faith to people who have all kinds of needs, not just those that we might categorize as spiritual, whatever that means, but also the needs that we might characterize as physical or mental, emotional, the kind of human needs you see listed on the board here. If this isn't enough to take away your appetite, I don't know what is, because that's heavy stuff. There are 17 areas of need up there, 17, if you will, indicators that we're going to be looking at in a very broad kind of macro survey way in this session. This session will be repeated next week. I'll be doing 5 things next week, and in some respects they are somewhat connected. There'll be one on communication, because I think it's important that we learn in a multicultural setting, how do we communicate with each other? How do we hear each other? And there's going to be this particular one, which is taking a look at the social health of the country. And then there's one on the whole matter of what's happening to children. I think it's titled something like, it doesn't pay to be a child, or something like that. Because I'm really concerned about what's happening to children in this country. And by the time you sit through some of these, I suspect you will be even more concerned than you may be as you start. Then there'll be a session on poverty. Who are the poor today? And it will surprise you that the poor of a few years ago are no longer the poor in large numbers, but rather a whole new group of folks have emerged as the poor of today, who represent about 77% of those people who are living in poverty, which is about 32.5 million people in this country. And then both on Saturday of this week and then at the end of next week, I'm going to do something with the group because it's something I believe in as a part of the life of the church, a little thing called One Color Doesn't Make a Rainbow. And it has to do with what Fred was talking about a few moments ago here, of our commitment to becoming a multicultural, inclusive church. So that's kind of an overview of what I'll be doing among you. I only arrived yesterday, have felt very welcomed. I don't know how you knew it, but everybody greets me and says, I'm looking forward to this or that. It feels good to be included so quickly in a group. What we're going to be doing today is taking a look at a very useful study that is an ongoing study that comes out of Fordham University. It's a study that monitors the social well-being of American society. It's kind of like those indices that go together to create the gross national product, or the consumer price index, or the Dow Jones average. It's taking those kinds of principles and applying them to 17 different areas of concern for the social health of this country. I want to share something about this ongoing study. As we talk, I hope that you have questions on the spot. Raise your hand, we can talk right then. Otherwise, I'll kind of make a basic presentation and open up for conversation around what's shared. I've got a handout, but I think I'd like to wait until we get a little further on and share that with you because, among other things, I want you to listen to me and not just look at the page. The study that comes out of Fordham University measures the changes that are taking place in these 17 social problem areas. They have been monitoring these changes since 1970. So we have a pretty good, almost a 20-year period of data to work from. Now, if you were in business and your bar graph looked like that, what would you say?
Sell.
Sell, right? Give it away. That is the social health of this country, charted by using this kind of a statistical mathematical approach. 1970 is over here and it's at a 68. In 1987, which is the last year that we have published results on, it's around 36. As you begin to look at this and as we talk about this, you need to ask yourself, what happened in these years? For example, who was president? Most of those years in here, at least seven of them, Mr. Reagan, but that started declining under Mr. Carter. Also, some other things happened prior to this. If we could chart this back to the 50s, it would have been much worse back then because you had the war on poverty, which had its problems, but also made some substantial changes in the whole human service fabric of this country. The 17 areas that are covered in the study are these. For children, the whole matter of infant mortality. If you come to one of my classes next week where we take a look at some of the statistics on children prepared by the Children's Defense Fund, you'll see that our infant mortality rate is abominable when compared to other countries of the world. We'll be looking, they take a look at child abuse, what's happening in this country with a dramatic increase of reported child abuse and neglect around the country. They look at the whole matter of children in poverty. How many children fall below the poverty guideline established by the federal government as one indicator that's measured? Among youth, they look at the whole matter of teen suicides, drug abuse, and high school dropouts. In the area of adults, they look at such things as unemployment, a poverty head of household, and if you are working in human services, some of you said you were nurses, you're seeing more and more women who are heads of households. Dramatic increase in that area. What's the impact? They look at things like the health insurance gap and the unemployment insurance gap. For example, the unemployment insurance gap is the difference between the number of people who are eligible for unemployment compared to those who get it. And there's quite a gap. And then in the area of aging, which by definition in this study is those over 65, they look at how many people are in poverty there who are living below the poverty guideline as one indicator. And then how much does that person have to pay out of pocket for health care costs, a major indicator of the social health of the country. It's been said by many people that you can tell something about the values, the priorities of a nation in terms of how it deals with its aging population. And this is one of the indicators. And then for all groups, five different areas, the whole matter of homicides. What do you think is happening in the area of homicides across the country? It is increasing. As recently as Monday in USA Today, a major front page article, USA's 1990 murder toll may be worse. If you want to see how it is in your state, here are the figures. I live in what's called the murder capital of the country. It's a major issue in Washington, D.C., not for tourists. You have to be a druggie. You have to be involved in the street scene there. That's a very tough scene. So come on and be our tourists. We love you. But that's not the issue for you. But we are living in an increasingly violent society. One of the pieces that's measured. Another one is the whole matter of how many highway deaths are related to alcohol and alcohol abuse. Still another one, the food stamp gap. Another one, the gap between the rich and the poor. And finally, the lack of affordable housing. Now, what's missing from that list? I just noticed it. What do you see missing?
Whole question of AIDS.
Yeah, AIDS is not there. No. That's a fairly recent. Back in 1970, when this was started in terms of tracking, that was not an issue. Yeah, what else do you see?
Education.
This is not designed to address that, although that's a significant factor. Yeah. What else?
Healthcare.
You get it in terms of healthcare cost here.
Health insurance gap,
you get it there. What is it, about 35 million Americans have no health care coverage at all? When Sarah is here the next hour, and you'll meet her all next week, she works for the Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs in Washington, D.C., on your behalf. And she's an advocate there on Capitol Hill, and her major area of concern is health care. So quiz her on it. There's a lot happening in that area. Anything else you see? Yeah, that is not there and probably would not be. But it's an indicator of something, certainly.
What about homelessness? Is that something?
Homelessness is not there, except as it comes in the area of the lack of affordable housing. The one big one that I noticed that's totally missing for the general population is this one, which is expanding dramatically in terms of the adult, not just youth.
What's on the old group?
What was that?
You meant what was missing under all groups?
No, the whole thing. Just to kind of get you thinking about it. Okay. What we'll see is that in 1970, quite a few of these were ranked in what they developed as kind of a good area. We were making healthy progress in these areas. What's happened from 1970 to 1987 has been an erosion of that progress. It was the progress that was made in the 60s and into the early 70s. And it's the kind of progress that has not been sustained and certainly was not sustained during the years of the 80s when the priorities of our country were in other directions. Where we had a social policy that in many respects dismantled much of what was accomplished in the 60s and into the mid 70s. And we're living now, for years to come, with the results of that social policy. Now, if you take what I'm saying to be political, you're correct. But it's not just one person. It's the policy of this country that we were involved in. The answer to what we're going to see is the reshaping of the values and the policies of this country. A number of years ago, this country did say, we do not believe anyone should go hungry. Now, we haven't solved that yet, but it became a national kind of issue. And out of that came valuable programs like the food stamp program and WIC and others. It wasn't too many years ago when, and I'm giving you a hint about one of the other sessions, but when one of the largest groups in poverty were older adults. And that number has been dramatically changed by groups like the Black Panther, or the Gray Panthers. Yeah, great. Let me get my color right. Gray Panthers, by AARP and other citizens groups who have applied the kind of pressure that could even cause Congress to enact a law one year and change it the next. And that just happened within the last year or so. The whole matter of catastrophic health care. We can change the priorities. We can change the values of this country. And now with the whole changing world scene, we're in the place to impact that change. If we have the will and the heart and the stomach to do it. That's kind of getting to the end of the day, but let's go back and see what the study shows, although you know already. There isn't a lot of surprise once you see the graph. Some may be areas of surprise, but basically, no. The overall picture came from 68 on the scale to 35. I said 36 earlier. 8 of these 17 areas reached their lowest level in 1987, the last year that has been charted. Performance improved in 3 areas. What I'd like to do is hand this out now, and I don't know how many of you there are, but I think you're going to have to share, because I brought enough for 30 people this week and 30 next, and I'm sure there's more than 30. So get friendly with the person next to you. And Holden also said don't use a lot of paper, so we printed on both sides. But I thought you ought to have something visual to look at. Let's see if we can get them spread around enough so that you can all see off of it. Let's turn to the side that's on the back of the bar chart. In other words, the one that's called Levels of Performance 1970, 78, and 87. Got that side? Okay. You'll see that according to the charting in the program that's used for this monitoring system, that a number of these 17 areas were listed as in the good area. That doesn't mean perfect, but it means that substantial progress was in evidence in the year 1970. Such as children in poverty. We had moved dramatically from where we were earlier. Let me just give you a figure on that might surprise you where we were. In 1959, first of all, the poverty rate for the country was 22% of the population living below the poverty line. Today, it's about 13.5%. And it's gone down. You can see this chart. Appreciably in those years where the war on poverty and other social programs were in effect. And now it's kind of been flat and starting up a little bit. The children in poverty was in the good area in 1970. Where is it in 1987?
Poor.
Yeah. Child abuse was in the good area in 1970. Where is it today?
Poor.
And it's probably a lot lower for 1988 and 89. Teen suicide was in the good area. Where is it today?
Poor.
Well, you can read across there. Notice that those in the good area of the index are shrinking, so that 1987, all that you see, that we've still been able to maintain some degree of health, is infant mortality, high school dropouts, poverty over 65, and look at where that was in 1970. That was in the poor area. And with the efforts of many groups and many individuals, it has risen so that we have dramatically decreased the numbers of people and the percentage of people in poverty who are over 65 years of age. And unemployment has remained rather consistent across this period of time, moving from in the good area all 3 years, according to this particular tabulation. As you look at it, do you see any surprises? Anything that makes you wonder about it?
There's almost a reversal between the poor for 1970, areas of poor to the area.
Yeah, real shifting, this way and this way. Yeah, and some that stayed remain pretty constant across. Other observation?
Well, is it possible that some programs are suffering because of the attention given to other programs, like, for instance, in 1970, children in poverty wasn't such an issue, but infant mortality was, so the programs for the poor things maybe started taking emphasis.
Priorities, I'm sure, can have that kind of effect. However, what we've seen in the area of children in poverty has been the dramatic increase in female-headed households. And when you look at who's at risk of becoming poor, female-headed households is at the top, along with if you live in the South, along with if you're black, along with some others like that. But it's not a very good day to be a female going through divorce and having children. Your chances of making it economically through a divorce when you have children, probably 50-50. So we've seen this dramatic rise in female-headed households, which has then brought millions of children into the poverty group. That's oversimplified, but it's kind of the broad piece. Yes?
I can't believe the unemployment has stayed good.
I wonder about that too.
I think Reagan changed the method of measuring.
Well, he did. Yeah, gerrymandered. Yeah, he put the military and the employee.
Yeah, you're not counted as unemployed after a certain number of weeks, too.
Yeah.
And so there's a whole group of people that are lost, who are, in a sense, perpetually unemployed, or work a little bit and then are unemployed. All these folks go on are the figures that are published, and so there will be some places, I think, where we could seriously raise the question. We would also have to look at each year to see, and the unemployment indicator, which we don't have in this. This, incidentally, is published in a little book, and you're welcome to not take mine, but get the address off and send for it. I think it may even be free. Or if it's not free, it's not much. And it's a good little book, and I get it every year, and I keep watching it. It's only been published the last couple of years, because I think that people like myself who are in human services need to know what the trends are. And so often, you don't have those trends unless you have something like this to assist you. Other observations as you look at those...
Yeah. Does that mean that we worked on those areas?
Apparently there was some work, something happened to address that. High school dropout, while we're still concerned about that, apparently the efforts have paid off. We know that poverty for persons over 65 have paid off dramatically. The figures on that, just to give you another idea, this is another little book we'll be using this week called Women and Children Living in Poverty. And it's put out by the ELCA. It's a report to the ELCA. A lot of good material in here to study. And there is a little chart here that shows that in terms of the over 65 population, in 1959, 35% of our older population were living below the poverty line. Today it's 12%. We've made substantial progress because of the efforts of many people. And Congress listens to votes. And Congress can be influenced by groups like Gray Panthers and AARP and others. Other observations on this? Yes?
Does the book look... break down any of these areas by racial groups?
No, this study does not do that. Some of the other studies do it, and come next week and I'll share some of that with you.
Because high school dropout, whether it be some blacks, whether that's gone up.
Yeah, those distinctions are not applied in this. This is kind of the macro view of social health. A couple of other sessions will be looking at more of the micro, the focusing in, as will Sarah, who's doing several of these also. Sarah's tending to look more in her sessions, and I really encourage you to stay for the next hour. It's going to be a good hour. You're going to see a video, which where she gets, yeah, just skip dinner. I mean, you can get bread any place. Is the snack bar open? I don't know. I have some granola bars if you want to have one afterwards. But she's going to be looking more in terms of black experience and poverty, as well as women and children. But so we kind of overlap, and that's okay, because when you get one, what you don't get from one, you get from the other.
Well, I'm thinking of the two groups you mentioned for the aging, AARP and Gray Panthers. They're predominantly white dominated groups. Therefore, Congress listens more to the
We have those figures, and let me just share those with you, because if I can find the page they're on here. I know. What you'll see, just using that area as an example, is that we said earlier that in terms of the white population over 65, and that figure I gave you earlier of 35% was for all. White population over 65 in poverty, it was 33% in 1959. It was 62% in the same year for the black population, and 25% for Hispanic. They have gone down some, although Hispanic is not, and that's one of the interesting pieces. It's gone from 25% to 27% in 1987. Black has gone from 62% to 33%. Now, I don't know why, but it's an interesting thing that within the Hispanic groupings, there has not been that increase in terms of diminishing the numbers of older adults who are living below the poverty line. Statistics don't tell you everything, but they give you a good snapshot. And we need to learn from it, especially as you can look at statistics in terms of trends. And that's why I like this particular study so much. It gives us some idea, and it confirms what we sense. You know, those of you who work in human services, you know that things are getting worse. You just experience that. You feel it. This puts some data on top of that. But you don't even have to be in human services. You walk down the streets of your city. And some of you mentioned earlier homelessness. You didn't have that in the great numbers we have it now, even 10 years ago, did you? Wasn't there. And now, one of the things that I'm kind of riding as a hobby horse these days is to help people understand that the building of shelters has become a part of the problem. That you don't solve homelessness by building temporary shelters. You need that Band-Aid when you need a place to stay overnight, but the shelters don't solve the problem. Homelessness is going to be solved by a variety of other strategies, among them affordable housing, which in the Reagan years decreased 76%. Yeah. So you got to look at the root. The root cause situation. Shelters have been important to people. They have saved many a life. They've also kept some people caught. In Northern Virginia, our agency serves not only District of Columbia, but a couple of Maryland counties and four counties in Northern Virginia. In Northern Virginia, which is a very affluent area, more than 80% of the people in shelters work. They're not homeless. They can't afford to live in the community where they work. That may not be an issue for you and where you're from. It sure is where I live. I was over in Wenatchee on Monday and got in a day early. Thought I'd do Wenatchee, and I did it in about 30 minutes. But one of my stops was in front of a real estate office, and I saw the pictures there of the houses that were being sold, and oh, wow. You know, 2,500 square feet, multiple bathrooms and all, $7,500, you know. In D.C., you can't get a shanty for $75,000. So what's in back of it, you know, of homelessness is that homelessness, in effect, has become a part of the problem. That is the building of shelters, the building of temporary systems. And as important as they've been to people, they're not the answer. And it's interesting to talk to people in D.C. around that issue, and they all say the same thing, even though we're operating major shelters there. You also have to address the whole matter of the deinstitutionalization of the mentally ill. We have deinstitutionalized people. We haven't provided the support systems in enough numbers to support them because they are still chronically mentally ill and need certain support systems, which they had in the institution at great cost and at risk of violating their civil rights as human beings. Anything else?
In 1970, we see poverty household as fair, then it moves us to good in 1978,
mm-hmm.
and it moved back down to fair in 1987.
Yeah. I don't know what caused that. Let me see if there's anything on that that might be helpful. Poverty head of household, householder in families, yeah, it gives their sources, it doesn't say. I don't know, what would have caused that? When you look at the poverty...
Oh, that would be poverty, that's what I mean, poverty head of household, and that would be the statement you made earlier, that the woman...
Yeah, what's happened? What's happened in this? And it's really interesting to look at. Again, we'll deal with it in more detail next week. As I look at the statistics and try to understand what do they say, it's that there are two kinds of head of households and used in the statistics. One is the married head of household or male head of household, and the other is female head of household, single parent. And we've seen the married or male head of household greatly diminish, but the female head of household greatly, dramatically increase. I suspect this figure may put them together, and therefore it doesn't move a lot. That would be my guess. Okay, let me just conclude, and then we'll have some more conversation. The time does go quickly.
Sure.
And you're a good group. You're a sensitive group, and I really appreciate your questions. This year, for the first time, this particular study out of Fordham University begins to lift out the whole matter of the social health of children and youth as a separate index. And they have identified six critical problem areas, and they won't surprise you. One is certainly the area of child abuse. And incidentally, you don't have it in front of you, but that pattern looks like this. Not too much different from the overall. But as they looked at that, the six areas, child abuse, they've seen, for example, that from 1970 to 1987, the increase in the rate of child abuse three times over. It has tripled. Nurses, I bet you run into it all the time. We do in our work at an LSS agency of children. And now, of course, the new phenomena, and I don't know if it's in your community, does the name border baby say anything to you?
What's the term?
Border baby. Okay, maybe it's coming. Or maybe you've solved it. In some of the eastern cities and some of the other urban areas, border babies are coming to the surface. Everybody's talking about it. Even the Federal Register has some RFPs out, requests for proposal, to put together programs to respond to the growing numbers of border babies. Now, it's not millions, it's not hundreds of thousands, it's in the teens in some hospitals. These are babies who have been abandoned. Most likely they are drug addicted babies, or their mother is addicted, and they become a ward eventually of the city or the county or the state or whatever your system is. And at tremendous cost to a hospital. They can't have anybody to get reimbursement from. The child is abandoned. If they can't find the mother or father, they're stuck there. It takes months for the courts to release them to become wards of the state, to get into foster care, to get into adoption, or whatever the the permanency plan for that child is going to be. Some of these babies have AIDS. For whatever reason, they are abandoned at birth or shortly after birth, and it's a growing phenomenon, not large numbers, very expensive and very tough on the babies, and the kind of bonding that needs to take place and the kind of nurture. So we have a whole neat volunteer culture developing in D.C. of people like you and me who go, and some of these are men, which is beautiful, they go to hospitals and just hold babies, hold border babies, to give them some nurturing and some stimulation that they need even as a very young child. It's a crazy world, and if it hasn't hit your community, be grateful. I hope it doesn't, but it has us. It's in New York. I think it's in Detroit, some of the other major urban areas in the East, certainly. Border babies. You may call these children something else. You may have another term, yeah. But it's coming, just like the AIDS epidemic continues to challenge us. And to challenge a whole lot, not only healthcare issues, but our theological persuasions about people who are not like us. Yeah. And that's something we have to deal with. We'll talk about that Saturday, when we deal with one color doesn't make a rainbow. Second issue is the whole matter of children in poverty. Since 1970, the increase has been about 25%, so that today, one child in five is living in poverty. A lot of kids. One in five. And it's projected by the end of the century that could well be 25% if the present trends continue. Suicides, they've doubled since 1970 among young people. Drug abuse, the interesting thing here is that this has increased significantly since the 70s, but it's not at the level of the 60s. Flower children, marijuana, all of that. But it's growing, and that ought to be a concern for us. High school dropouts worsened in 1987, the last year of the study, after 10 years of improvement. It's kind of like, is that one bad year a new trend? Or is it a glitch? And we start continuing that trend toward improvement. And then infant mortality, there's been general improvement, and you see that by its moving from the poor area to the good area. The percent of deaths in this country of infants continues to fall, but in that same period of time, the United States has slipped from sixth in the world to 18th. Among industrialized nations, we are behind such countries as Singapore, Hong Kong, Spain, and Ireland when it comes to infant mortality.
How can we rate it as good then?
Yeah.
It's only good because we have improved, I suspect. This study does not compare it to the international scene. It's saying compared to where we were, we have improved. But this is only a study of these indicators in this country. That's why I have to come next week, because we'll get into the international, and then we're going to be really nasty and show you how your state's doing in some of these areas. You might be surprised. For example, where do you think the best place to live for children is?
Washington.
Minnesota. Montana.
Vermont.
Well, you have to come next week and find out. Yeah, and the books I've got up here you can get for yourself. There are three books that I think are musts for anybody who's concerned about the social health of the country. One is this one. Came out of the Institute for Mission and a report to the ELCA. And then this is, you wouldn't be bothered if I said this is one of my Bibles, would you? Hey, the truth is spoken many places, not just between leather covers, you know. This is called Children 1990, put out by the Children's Defense Fund in Washington, D.C. How many of you have heard of CDF? Well, you all should. This is must reading in an election year. This is a primer that will help you understand what's happening to children and what you can do about it politically, what you need to be doing about it. when you, with Sarah in her sessions, talk to her about that. That's her business. That's her life's passion, to not just be an advocate herself, but to mobilize the church to be an advocate. On a given Monday morning, how many Lutherans are in the country? Yeah, 11 million?
No.
Well, we have 5 million of them in the ELCA.
All right, let's just take the ELCA. If on a given Monday morning, 5 million letters hit Congress on any subject, you want to talk about power? That's power. Just do half of those, 2.5 million. In Arizona, we used to talk about that. I used to be the executive of Lutheran Social Services there for about 9 years. That's also one of the lowest states. You don't want to move to Arizona if you have a child. It's one of the worst states to live in. The bottom is New Mexico. But come next week and find out about yours.
How many of us are going to be here next week?
If you come up and ask me, I'll look it up for you. How's that? No, I'd be happy to pull it out right now if you're interested. Vermont is considered the best place by the Children's Defense Fund for a child to grow up, in terms of the kind of issues they're looking after. Maine, Massachusetts, Minnesota. But don't get too happy. Yours is still, you get 55% on your report card from CDF. And Maine and Vermont is 65. There's nobody even above that. You have their voting records in this of all of your people on major children's issues. Marvelous little book. California, South Carolina, still up almost 50%. The low side are New Mexico, South Dakota. Hey, there's Lutherans there. Kansas, Idaho, Colorado, Missouri, Mississippi, Georgia, Arizona are in the bottom. Who did I miss?
Washington.
Well, I start on the good side here and I don't see it.
Wasn't admitted to the union, was it?
It's slipping by me here. Yo, you're 40% on your report card.
How about Wyoming?
Wyoming. 25%.
How about Illinois?
Illinois. That one should be high. Yeah, 40%.
Wisconsin.
Do
Nebraska.
Nebraska. Boy, found out how to get these people's interest. Start talking state stuff here. I can't even. Oh, 25%. Boo. Wisconsin, 40%.
Ed, looking at that. Good.
Just wanted to let everybody know that book is available in the Resource Center. You can come on up your stage.
There you go.
Don't take it out of the Resource Center.
And don't take mine either. But write to them. They love to put stuff out. Kathy Guy on the CDF staff is a Lutheran. And her job is to work with church relationships, and she's very happy when she gets a letter from a Lutheran saying, I'd like to have some of this stuff.
And looking at it quickly, just as you're looking at it, can you discern north, east, south, and west, or Midwest type thing?
Yeah, yeah. Again, that's next week. But there's a handy dandy little chart in here. I think it's on page 55. It says, it isn't on 55. Basically, it says if you don't want to live in the South, that's where the poorest will be. It shows that the Midwest and the West are pretty even, and the East, Northeast is about where the Midwest and the West. If you can see this, this is the South. Mm-hmm. The two bars are the stripes, which will be the one on your left, are white, and the black is the black population. This is the South and the condition of poverty there. Mm-hmm. Compared to the West, West has a very much smaller black population. And the Midwest, about equal, and the Northeast.
Does that sort out Indian and Hispanic populations, Paul?
No, there's not enough Indian, Native American, to chart that most of these people say. Hispanic is done, but it's not on this particular chart. Some neat charts in here. We'll be looking at some of these next week also. We have, it looks to me like about two more minutes for comments or questions. I hope we've whetted your appetite to look at, you know, what's happening to the social health of our country, and how does it impact all people, and how does it impact major groupings in our society, not only in terms of ethnic groupings, but in terms of gender.
One of the comments we've noted around Seattle, and I don't have real figures, but just through conversations with people within my own church and work with our multi-service center, is the new poor in the suburb areas of the city of Seattle. And it's hard for us average people to realize how many poor people are now walking the streets of these cities that we think of as being very rich. Mm-hmm. It's becoming like downtown Seattle.
Yeah. And what you said reminded me of something. Some of us were in here with Fred from the ELCA office in Chicago talking about the plans of the church to become more inclusive. We tend to think only of racial inclusiveness. Mm-hmm. But what about poor folk, mm-hmm, who need the good news just as much as rich people like us? What about people who are challenged by a variety of physical or emotional issues in their life? And what about the gay and lesbian community? And what about, you know, and you can list them all. That's Saturday, One Color Makes a doesn't Make a Rainbow. We're going to have a little fun with that. But yeah, it's changing. And the church cannot continue to look like what it used to look like, either visually or in its composition. If we believe that we are a church, and I'm preaching right now, forgive me, but if we believe we are a church that has good news for all people, we don't have a choice. There is no choice but that we are to proclaim that good news, we're to act it out to the whole community. And so, you know, my wife and I, Sarah is black, you'll discover in a few minutes. And we went to Washington, D.C. from Arizona, and Arizona is a pretty regressive place for persons of color. In Arizona, I used to like to shock people in churches and tell them that, you know, there are three Native Americans for every one Lutheran. Now, who's the minority, folks? But Sarah and I were thinking, wow, we're going to move to Washington, D.C. The church is finally going to look like our family. That was a mistake. I almost said something stronger. And I don't think we should be satisfied until our church looks like its community. We are not a church just for Northern European folks, as nice as you are. But where is that inclusive group even here in Holden in a week? Yeah. That's supposed to be a multicultural week, you know.
Yeah.
And we're still coming up short. We need to be challenged by that. And you need to go home and challenge your church council or your pastor to let loose and become a church for that community totally. And that includes those poor folks, and that includes people in shelters every place else. Yes?
If you would hold up that book.
Yes, ma'am.
You can get this book free from the women of the ELCA if you will write Doris Streeter at the headquarters address, and I can give that to you if you want it.
Yeah.
This book has a lot of good data in it. This one has a lot of passion as well as good data. If you ever met Marion Wright Edelman, who's the head of the Children's Defense Fund, you will never forget her. Marvelous person. And we're fortunate to have her in D.C. And then this one is just more statistics and so forth. But put them together, you begin to see a picture that's frightening. We've got an epidemic on our hands, including all the others that we've got. And that is the deterioration of the kind of services that people have a right to. Now, you may not agree with that. I happen to believe we need to have some form of national health care, or at least universal access to health care. I happen to believe that food is a right of every American as well as everyone in the world, but just thinking about this country at this point. I think shelter is a basic right. And unless we have dealt with some of those basic things, we as a nation are not a very civilized group of people. That's my opinion. Be happy to chat with you around the campus, around those issues or anything else. We have reached time for our non-dinner. Thank you for being here. You're a good group of folks, and we'll see you Saturday.